Welcome to the Writer's Weekly Podcast, a forum geared toward the writing enthusiast and those who want to make money from their writing. I'm Brian Whitten, Managing Editor of Writer's Weekly, and I'll be your host along with Angela Hoy, the creator of Writer's Weekly and President and CEO of BookLocker.com, a full-service book publishing company. Whether you want to learn how to become a professional writer, how to find writing gigs, or even publish your own book, then you come to the right place. We'll be discussing all kinds of topics relating to the writing and publishing industries. Don't forget, you can also click over to writersweekly.com. There, you'll find not only thousands of articles about professional writing, you can also find current paying markets and job listings to help you boost your writing career and even your bottom line. But for now, let's get on to this episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. We're sorry about not having an episode last week. However, Angela and I both came down with COVID. I got it first, had it for about a week, and then Angie caught it from me. So we were just unable to sit and record another episode last week. This week, we're going to talk about legal questions that were sent to us from people online, both in our social media and directly through email. We're going to have attorney James Walsh helping us answer these questions. So we hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back in just a minute with that episode. Hey, folks, the WritersWeekly.com short story contest for summer 2025 is right around the corner. Don't wait around to sign up. We only allow 500 people to sign up, and the sign-up fee is only $5. Now, the start date is Saturday, July 19th, 2025 at 12 p.m. Central Time. Now, first place winner gets a $300 cash prize plus a free book publishing package from BookLocker.com valued at $975. So that's over $1,000 worth of prize for the first place winner. Also, second place winner gets a $250 cash prize. Third place winner gets a $200 cash prize. Also, all three of those winners get the publication of their winning story on the WritersWeekly.com's contest website. They will also receive a one-year free subscription to the Write Markets Report and a free writing-related print or ebook of the winner's choice from BookLocker.com. Also, first and second place winners will have their stories read on the Writers Weekly podcast by me, complete with background music and sound effects. Now, we did this a few episodes ago, so go back and listen to those. I think you'll like what you hear. I know that those winners really appreciated having their stories read on our podcast. Additionally, we have 100 honorable mention prizes, and that will include a one-year subscription to the Write Markets Report and a free writing-related ebook of the winner's choice from BookLocker.com. So there's lots of prizes to be had. Again, time's running out. It's right around the corner next month, and there's only 500 people allowed to sign up. So lock in your space and get in on this contest, and maybe you can win that free BookLocker publishing package. So go to 24hoursshortstorycontest.com. That's the number 24hoursshortstorycontest.com. That's all one word. And sign up for your spot in the 24-hour short story contest sponsored by writersweekly.com. So today we're doing another episode with James Walsh Esquire, an attorney in Pennsylvania, and over the last couple of weeks, we had people writing in questions from a legal standpoint for us to ask James so that he can research and answer these for you, and we're going to do that today. So, James, how are you doing today?
I'm well. How about yourself?
Good, good. So it's been a few weeks since we've had you on. Can you just, to refresh our listeners' memory, tell us a little bit about yourself?
My background in law originated with the military. I was Navy JAG, I was stationed in New London, Connecticut, with a submarine base, and I split toward to Sicily, Naval Air Station Sigonella. And from there, my background's primarily in criminal law and in commercial real estate. I'm currently in northeastern Pennsylvania. Previously, I was residing in Sicily.
Okay. And tell the listeners about your book and how you got involved with uncovering scams and researching publishing legalese.
Well, I kind of tripped into penning a novel as a co-author. The novel is Maximum Impact, and a friend of mine had reached out to me when I was in Sicily and asked me to help edit his novel. And that editing turned into a co-authorship, and he signed on with a company publishing Mojo, which we all know is a scam. And almost from the inception, I had a lot of questions, and unfortunately, my partner was taken for almost $5,000. And basically, it became my mission to get that money back and to reveal Publishing Mojo for who they were, which is basically a fraud. And it was a Pakistan fraud actually operating out of California. And
Sort of.
well, yeah, there is a physical location in California, but which is unusual. But in any event, as time went on, it became apparent to me that this wasn't just my partner, that it's a pervasive practice on Facebook and with Meta Platforms Inc., Instagram, and LinkedIn. I mean, it permeates the internet, and by and large, I mean, it's astronomical, as you know, Angela. We started out. I remember mentioning to you that we marveled at 25 scammers, and now today we're at darn close to 1,000, if not more than a
Actually,
thousand.
our spreadsheet now is over 1500.
That's
And
crazy.
this isn't just Publishing Mojo, though they're part of the problem. It's I think three or four core companies operating thousands of websites.
Yeah, no, you hit it on the head, because it was funny. Well, it's not funny, but yesterday I was surfing Facebook, and they're almost, I could call them doppelgangers, but the websites are almost exactly the same. And I agree with you that there are a core four or five individuals or corporations or entities that are just proliferating these bogus publishing websites. And
Right, yeah. So I met you while you were doing it, and I was doing Exposing the Scammers, and we've got quite a big following of authors and writers that are frequently sending us questions, not just about the scammers, but about all things related to publishing. So we decided to have you on today, and these are questions that you've already received copies of them as well, that we received by email and through social media. Excuse me, I'm getting over COVID, so I'm going to be clearing my throat. So, Brian, would you like to dive into the first question?
All right, so the first question is from Sandra, and she asks, in a memoir, if you leave out a person who is a potential legal issue, is it still advisable to change all the other names and locations, including using a pen name, or can you use real names?
Oh, I forgot. Legal disclaimer. My name is Angela Hoy. I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah, neither am I.
However, right, and Brian is not either. However, I've been in the business for more than 25 years, and I've pretty much seen it all. And all of the advice I give today is based on my opinion. James Walsh is a lawyer, but he's not your lawyer. So, if you have any specific legal questions related to your situation, you need to consult with your lawyer. This is just our opinions based on what we've been through and what we've seen. So, okay. So, James, you want to go first on that about the changing other people's names and locations and trying to protect yourself with that?
And so far as this individual is concerned, and I highlighted it for you, was potential legal issue right there is a flag. I don't know what the legal issue is, but obviously it's prudent for anyone who pens a novel that they actually obtain permission to use people's names or facts and circumstances. That's the safest route to go.
Including even if they're going to use different names, they should still get that person's permission, even if they're going to change that person's name. And they need to get it in a contract. They need a release from that person that's notarized, correct?
Doesn't necessarily, it's funny. I actually just reflected on this. I did not do it. It probably would have been, it's prudent to have something in writing. Maximum Impact, the core character in our novel, is actually a real person. We did obtain his permission. We did not do it in writing. It probably would be I shouldn't say probably, it's best to have it in writing, but both myself and my co-author know him personally. He actually ran for governor. He's one of the youngest. He was the youngest person to run for governor in Pennsylvania. But his name is Chuck Volpe. We obviously changed his name to Fox, which Volpe is Italian for Fox. So he's Chuck Fox in the book. But the most prudent course of action is to obtain a written permission. And obviously, this gives rise to the whole issue of invasion of privacy. And an invasion of privacy is basically, it's an intentional tort. Its intent is important because if I bump into Angela on the street, that's inadvertent. It's an accident. I step into a restroom that happens to be unisex. Accident, it's an intentional tort where you intentionally place somebody in a false light.
Even if it's true.
Even if it's true, there could be private facts that aren't meant to be public. And so if you divulge that or you appropriate their name or likeness, public disclosure of private facts or placing somebody in a false light, that gives rise to a cause of action for invasion of privacy. And obviously, you'd have to demonstrate that somehow your character has been impugned. You may have lost an opportunity for a job. So there's demonstrable damages that you have to set forth in order to succeed. But to digress again, the most prudent course of action is to obtain the consent of people who are involved in your novel. And I think the gal made reference to a pen name is not going to mask you from liability. It just simply serves no purpose.
If anybody can recognize themselves in your book, even if you've changed your name, or if somebody else recognizes that it's that person can sue you.
Absolutely.
And even if everything you wrote is completely correct, they can still sue you. The most interesting invasion of privacy story we had, and I think I brought this up in another podcast, is a father who's elderly now wrote a book about his life, and he mentioned in the book that his 16-year-old daughter had gotten pregnant, at the age of 16, and she read his book and she hired a lawyer. Invasion of privacy. So anyway, so let's move on to the next one.
All right.
Got a lot to cover.
Richard writes in, and I'm going to truncate his question a little bit. Apparently, he wrote a poem back in the 60s, and it has to do with where he went to school as a kid. And I'm just kind of scanning through here. He used a teacher's real last name as well as first names of some of the students he went to school with, made such references as to Mrs. Klepper's china closet that was on sale at an auction. Somebody, in other words, basically was naming several people that he grew up with, real people, real names, several of which are now deceased. He's saying that now I'm hearing that I cannot do that, even if most of those participants are long ago deceased, unless I would have those people's or their relatives' legal permission to do so. Okay, so what is the rule on this? And he also asks, is it illegal to use the term Kleenex in a poem instead of the innocuous word tissue? Because apparently in his poem, Kleenex rhymes with something that he doesn't want to have to change the poem for.
Well, that's the easy part. Let me jump on that real quick. Here's the example that I give to authors. You can say in your novel, she enjoyed a nice, refreshing Coca-Cola. What you cannot say in your novel is she got food poisoning from drinking Coca-Cola. And that's a pretty simple way to think about it. If you're writing in your novel, don't make the company sound bad if you're going to use one of the company's brand names.
So I can't say I used a Kleenex and my nose fell off?
No.
Okay.
No.
A lot of these questions are fact-driven, and this is my opinion, but given the age and the fairly innocuous, doesn't appear to be incendiary or in poor taste, it's just a poem, my opinion would be to go ahead and roll with the poem. And one of the things that came to mind with the historical significance was that I thought about Tom Brokaw in the Greatest Generation. And I'm going out on a limb here, but I doubt that he dotted every I and crossed every T in terms of the people that he covered in that book. But it was in a very favorable light. It was, very positive rendition of historical facts. So I don't see an issue with rolling with this.
Yeah, it's, lots of people write about their childhood and their school and their schoolmates and their teachers, and they use real names. And honestly, if you're very complimentary towards those people, nobody's going to come back and sue you. I mean, well, of course, you can sue anybody for anything, but I just don't. Reading this email from this author, I really don't think that this person has a problem publishing their poem.
No. And then it's funny because this issue came up in my book. You asked me if there was any trademark issues and I made reference to a Tempur-Pedic mattress because it kind of, gave the idea that it was elegant and, it wasn't your ordinary bed. And I ascribed the registered trademark to it. And I think you said to me, and I agree, was that, as long as you don't place a company in a bad light, for example, using the word Kleenex or Clorox or Xerox, mm-hmm. Any name brands. I think one of our writers later on will discuss it, but she made, can I make reference to an airline? Can I make reference to a specific type of car? Absolutely, as long as you don't place that product in a bad light. And then the other thing that's interesting too is that a lot of times with these organizations, they want to protect their name brand because as it becomes common parlance in our English language, like Kleenex and Clorox and hey, can you make me a Xerox? That actually dilutes their trademark. And
yeah.
But they've become adjectives and common nouns. We don't refer to it. Hey, may I have a tissue? Hey, do you have a Kleenex? It's become an adjective or a noun and it's common usage. But again, I'll echo what you have said is that as long as it's not placed in a bad light, this Kleenex caused the spread of COVID. You're not going to have an issue with using
it. And one idea is that if you do need to present a product in a negative light, make up the product, give it a completely unique name, Google it, the name, and call it something, like Snot Rags Incorporated instead of Kleenex. The Snot Sock.
Well, and you could, and if it's factual, you just kind of made me think of Ralph Nader with Unsafe at Any Speed, the Corvair. He wrote a book that was all about the Corvair and that it was unsafe and why it was unsafe. And
what's a Corvair?
Ralph Nader was a
classic car.
Oh, okay.
But Nader's Raiders, I think they called him, but he was a public advocate in the, I want to say it was in the 70s, and he went after General Motors with respect to the Corvair. But I mean, obviously there's a potential there for litigation, but it was factually correct. The vehicle was unsafe.
Yeah. And just to remind all the listeners, your book can be 100% factual and you can still get sued because there's no shortage of slimy lawyers, right, James? That will file frivolous lawsuits, assuming that an author or a publisher is rich. So it does happen. Before we move to the next question, this is a true story about one of our authors. He wrote a novel about a haunted hotel, and I think it was in North Carolina. I'm not sure. He is now deceased. God bless him. We visited him and his wife a couple times over the years. He used a real hotel in his hometown with the hotel's permission, and they put copies of that book in all of their rooms, and they sold copies from their front desk. But again, he obtained permission, and that book sold very well. So that was a really good marketing idea. All right, Brian, what's next?
Okay, Carol wants to know when include. She wants to talk all about recipes here. When including recipes in a book, whether fiction or nonfiction, I don't know what a fictional recipe is, but what are the guidelines? I was, quote, told if you change just one thing, you avoid any copyright issue. Can you use item brand names in ingredient lists or otherwise without getting the company's permission? If a friend gives you a recipe, do you need written permission to include it? What about family recipes? What about family recipes that may have been copied from a source that you did not know about? Are there any disclaimers that need to be included, not including any medicinal concoctions or applications for health? What about good source of vitamin C as an example?
Well,
that's a lot of questions.
Yeah, that is a lot of questions. We actually covered this in Writers Weekly, and I will put a link on writersweekly.com/podcast underneath this episode where everybody can read about it. There is a special page on the Library of Congress website concerning copywriting of recipes. Yes, you can use brand names. Everybody does it for, you know, recipe ingredients. You can give advice about vitamins, but you need to put a disclaimer on your copyright page explaining that, you know, you're not a healthcare provider. We have three disclaimers that we give. They were written by lawyers that we give to our authors, and I will also post a link to those under the episode so people can use that. Specifically, you really can't copyright an ingredients list. That's basically what the law says. And again, I'll put a link under this episode. You can't copyright, you know, half a teaspoon of sugar and a quarter teaspoon of salt and this. You can't copyright that. What you can copyright is how you describe how to make that recipe. So you can't get online and say, oh, I found this recipe, I'm going to throw it in my book. And I found this recipe, I'm going to put it in my book. You have to come up with your own description on how to make that food. But you can copy the ingredients and the amounts.
James, you got anything on the recipe stuff?
If there's general assertions, or they call or puffing your wares, you can certainly say that, you know, obviously oranges, we all know, are high in vitamin C. You know, so if oranges are a main ingredient, there's nothing wrong with general puffery or general assertions, high in fiber. Obviously, if there's the ingredients are, you know, beans, obviously it's high in fiber. But what you have to steer clear from is, for example, stops COVID dead. You're not going to be able to back up that assertion. So general puffing of your wares and your recipe is perfectly fine, but you got to be careful with very specific claiming that it, you know, can stave off cancer. Those are areas you want to steer clear of.
Right. Yeah. All right. Next.
All right. Vivian asks us, I'm writing a fiction based on a true story. I'll use real people when facts are known. In this book, an 1850s lawsuit occurs, which involves a transaction where a well-known, well-respected Texan allegedly sold a prime piece of family's land fraudulently. The Texas Supreme Court years later dismissed the case. The story is only told from the family's point of view, however. Will writing this story put me in any legal jeopardy from anyone by alleging there was impropriety by that well-known Texan?
I actually, James and I went back and forth a few emails about this one. I went to the author, Vivian, and asked her for more information, and then I researched it. So this young man back in the 1800s, he was single, and he was given a plot of land in Texas. He died. One of his relatives agreed to sell it to this guy who, on a handshake, it was a handshake deal. And then the guy who bought the land didn't hold up his end of the bargain about whatever was supposed to happen. And, again, this is what, almost 200 years ago, that family through the years went to court. The family of the man who died went to court. They wanted that land. Apparently, one of the Capitol buildings in Texas is sitting on that land now. So they went back and forth with the state of Texas, and the Texas Supreme Court threw it out, you know, 150 years later. My advice about this, and James may disagree with me, is all these people are long dead. And talking about, even in a novel about a case that went before the Texas Supreme Court, by the way, I could not find those filings anywhere. I think it was just way too long ago. If it was me, I would do it. I would publish that book. I would write and publish, and I wouldn't worry about anybody trying to sue me for something that happened 200 years ago. James?
Yeah, no, I'm not in disagreement with you given the age. And then also, and obviously we did have banter back and forth with the author trying to ascertain more facts, but it's my understanding that this is not the core of her novel. It's more than just an aside, but it's not the core of the novel. But as long as she followed the course of events factually through the courts, it's not really placing anybody in a bad light. I mean, they're public documents. And if she can substantiate that this is, in fact, what was alleged, I found it interesting that it was, you know, 30 years later that the Supreme Court ruled. In any event, no, I agree with you. I'm not in disagreement that given the age of the case, and if she spoke just factually to what took place in the court system, I don't think there's an issue there.
I mean, even if, and there are members of that family alive today, they really wouldn't have any grounds to sue her at all. She's writing about something that happened.
They couldn't turn around and say, wait a minute, my, you know, great, great grandfather didn't think that or say that or
that makes sense.
I mean, this kind of falls into that fictional story based on true events.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, you got a disclaimer right there. This is a fictional story based on true events.
We give
names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Yeah. We give an example of historical fiction disclaimer for copyright pages to our authors. And if anybody wants that example, go to writersweekly.com. Click on contact us and send me an email and I'll send you that. James, you said this reminded you of Truman Capote in Cold Blood.
Well, yeah, that's what came to mind for me was Truman Capote's In Cold Blood was actually based upon a real murder in Kansas that had occurred 6 or 8 years prior. Obviously, In Cold Blood is a fictional novel, but and I also have to take note that it took place in an era where we were much less litigious. But, you know, this kind of reminded me of that novel that, I mean, if she's just giving a factual recantation of what took place in the courts and that this land was, in fact, in question, I don't think she'll have an issue.
Yeah, I don't think she will either. All right, Brian, who's next?
All right, Maria asks us, I got scammed by two companies in a row. Thought I'd learned my lesson the first time. How can I get my money back from them? I found out that they are both not located in the United States.
Well, that depends on how she paid them. If she did a bank transfer, she's screwed. If she used her credit card, she might be able to get her money back. She needs to contact her credit card company or her bank and immediately let them know, I got scammed by a foreigner. I'm issuing a chargeback. If you wait too long to do that, you will never get your money back.
Yeah, the safest way is through a credit card because you have the option of a chargeback. And, you know, and that's interesting because most of these scammers want you to either do a wire transfer, which is almost impossible to reverse. I recently inadvertently, believe it or not, an attorney friend of mine, we shared the last four numbers of our bank accounts. And I inadvertently sent him $500. It took me the better part of almost 2 months to get that money returned, even though we were both in accord that it was a mistake. So your best bet is a credit card, so you have the chargeback option, and steer clear of PayPal, Venmo. It's almost impossible to communicate with those companies if you have a payment issue.
Yeah. And sometimes when these companies, these third-party payment vendors are making money primarily from the businesses and not individuals, what's their incentive to side with the individual and to terminate the scammer's account? So, yeah. So you're
Exactly.
right. That's
Well, that's like what
well,
happened to me with my
and
PayPal
take
account.
the other thing
that's
too,
right.
that most of these people that bite on these frauds and these scams, it's impossible for service of process. You don't even know if that entity exists, which more likely than not it does not. They'll claim to be an LLC, they'll claim to be a corporation, they'll claim to be located in California, and they're not. So your biggest hurdle is service of process. It's impossible. But I mean, you do have the option to file with the FTC. The FBI has a reporting mechanism, as well as the Bureau of Consumer Protection in all 50 states.
Yeah, but we've seen how ineffective
Well,
those are. Ineffective those
oh,
are. There's just so
exactly.
many
I
scams
mean,
now. It's just like, grains of sand on the beach. You're just hoping one person will pick up that grain of sand and take a look at your case. And then in most cases, you will never hear back from that agency.
and then Brian brought up a great point in our last podcast, was there is no urgency. And that's a ploy on the part of these scammers to create a false sense of urgency that I've got to do this now and I've got to do it immediately. And that's, I mean, you could comment on that, Brian. It's a marketing tact, and there is no urgency. You hold the purse strings. And once you open up those purse strings, you're headed down a very bad path.
Especially when we're talking about these wire transfers, any publisher asks you for a wire transfer, right there, you got a big red flag.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, who asks for a wire transfer? Seriously. Wire transfers are usually used for like large amounts of money
Like when you're making a
to
down payment on your
on a
mortgage.
mortgage,
Yeah.
on buying a house, or if you're, buying a yacht from an international source or something like that, to send $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 for your book to be published, big red flag. And you need to start asking questions, if not scream and run.
We've heard a lot of excuses. Authors tell us their, the quote, publisher's scammer's excuse was, our credit card system's down today.
Yeah, wait till it comes back up.
Right. Or we don't take credit cards. Tell you what, if they don't have a merchant account and they can't accept credit cards, do not do business with them. Because now this brings up the emails I've been exchanging this week that I've shared with Brian and with James. A woman was working with one of these Pakistani scammers. And they kept, they do, a few pages at a time. We just would never finish her book. Every time they called her on the phone, they needed more money for this, that, or the other. And the last straw for her, and this is why she contacted me this week, was they said, hey, we owe you, I think it was $24,500 in royalties, but we can't pay you until we confirm that your account is active. So you need to wire us $4,000. We'll send it right back to you. But you need to wire us this money. And that's when she finally, after spending more than $12,000 to this company, that's when she realized it was a scam. The sad thing is, she still believed, as of this morning, because we were emailing this morning, she still believed there were unpaid royalties due to her.
Oh my
I
God.
told her, there are no
Better
royalties. They're
royalties.
not selling your book, and no copies have sold. There are no royalties whatsoever. Because she said, I just hate to walk away from all that money. I said, you're not walking away from anything. Thank God she contacted me instead of sending them the $4,000. She would have never heard from them again. Oh, and they were being extremely abusive to her.
I have gone through that electronic transfer test thing before, but it usually works the other way. The person that you are about to send money to will send you like a penny into an account and
Yeah.
then pull it back out. And then you confirm that you saw that penny go in and come back out again. And then you know that the connection's the way it's
You got $4,000.
This $4,000 thing, again, that's a screaming run flag right there.
And she had already given them her savings account number.
Yeah.
She had given them her Social Security number. And they actually threatened to sell or give away, to release her personal information if she didn't send them the $4,000 right then. And she was explaining to him, it's a bank holiday.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, figure it out. Send me my money. Anyway, thank God it was a bank holiday.
Yeah.
Or she may have made a bad decision.
Well, there you go. The mask comes off and basically it's just give me my money or I'm going to screw you.
Yep. Yeah. That's the basically the correspondence was really startling. And this is a well-known scammer that we've already got on our website. Mm. And they're impersonating a traditional publisher using the exact same name. All right, who's next?
All right, Jarrett X asks us.
Well, this is definitely a James one.
A publisher emailed me and said after I paid them that I have to sign an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. Should they be signing an NDA, not me, since they have my intellectual property? Why do I have to sign one? James, take it.
Yeah, that's all it is.
There's a couple of things. Angela, you could weigh in. I mean, I see no reason other than for the protection of an author, for an NDA to be involved. I'm not sure why this has crept into the mix, but I think it's our Pakistani frauds that are using this as a tool to appear legitimate and sophisticated. But from the onset, it's void because it's based upon fraud. My co-author signed an NDA. I'm like, well, you're signing an NDA with an entity that doesn't even exist. And I'm 100% positive that the individual doesn't even exist. It was a false name, but I think they're using it as an intimidation tool and to appear sophisticated. But first of all, it's completely unenforceable, assuming that they would ever try to enforce it. But there's absolutely no reason to sign an NDA with a publishing company other than, and Angela, you could probably weigh in on this, is that I would agree not to divulge the contract between us. Maybe there's certain terms in that contract that is specific to Writers Weekly or Book Locker or a Buzz Press that you want protected. And you don't want that information to be, you know, divulged. That's well, understandable, but I can't see any other reason other than an intimidation tool and to appear sophisticated.
I think the third reason they use it is because most authors aren't going to read that NDA and they're not going to realize that NDA says you can never say anything bad about the publisher ever online, anything. And it's a silencing tactic.
Well, yeah. But again, it's void from the onset because it's based upon fraud and,
yeah, so, but a lot of authors won't know that.
Oh, no.
And they'll just get screwed. We have never had NDAs. In fact, our contracts are available online for anybody to view because we don't have anything to hide. And I don't think any author should sign an NDA with any publisher because, I mean, again, it's like they're trying to hide something or they're trying to, you know, trick you later when you get upset. Trick you into being silent. And I think a lot of authors who've been scammed by these Pakistani, Filipino, and scammers in India, I think a lot of authors have signed NDAs and they think they're legit and they can't complain online that they've been scammed. And that scammers do that on purpose to try to get more business because the more people that complain, the more things are going to pop up when you Google their names. So I would tell that author, no, don't sign the NDA.
You know, in the case of anybody asking for an NDA, the whole purpose of an NDA is to keep things secret. And you'd have to ask yourself at any point, okay, what is it that this person wants to keep secret? What secrets are there in publishing a book?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Now, I've had authors say, will you sign an NDA before I send you my manuscript so you don't?
Hang on just a minute. James, you still with us?
Uh-oh.
Yeah, he dropped off. You can go ahead and keep talking, Angie. I'm going to wait for he should hopefully pop back up.
Oh, okay. Well, we're gonna have to pause anyway because I forget what I was saying.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, the NDAs, because I mean, like, if you go into, if you're a contractor going into business with somebody, and there is some information that they're sharing that they don't want to get out to the rest of the world because someone could take advantage of that to duplicate a product or duplicate the way they do business and basically take business away from them. Yeah, that's a fair use of an NDA. But again, what secrets are there in the publishing business,
right,
as far as, you know, the way people do things?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's no publishing company that has some proprietary method of publishing a book that they don't want anybody else to find out because it's so great.
Right.
No, everybody does basically, you know, the
basically
same
do
thing.
It the same way, same basic way. Yeah.
Okay. James is back with us now. He had a power surge. You know, this being the day after the U.S. bombed the Iranian nuke sites, I'm afraid that you might be being targeted by terrorists, James.
Oh, that was weird. But all right.
Is your power grid back up now?
Yeah, it just took me a while to get reconnected.
Do you have bottled water at the house? I would suggest perhaps not drinking from the tap for about 24 hours, just to make sure. Water treatment plants are a soft target. So.
All right, let's move on to the memoir one.
Memoir.
Excuse me.
Pat asks us, in my memoir, can I write about my children without their written permission since they were minors at the time that these things happened in our lives? Well, if you're saying your kids were a bunch of hellions that drove your life crazy, then it might be a bad thing. But...
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Well, I was going to ask you to go ahead.
Well, this is definitely fact-based, and I think the key is, you know, is the content of your writing, is it innocuous, or is it incendiary? And the one novel that came to mind was Mommy Dearest with Joan Crawford. And I believe, I'm not positive, but I believe there was litigation involved there because of the allegations that were made of abuse, physical and abuse. But if we go back to invasion of privacy, you know, number one, is there a reasonable expectation of privacy? That's the operative question. And then many states will require a prong that it has to be conduct that is extreme or outrageous. It just, so if you wrote about childhood experiences and factual things, you know, I don't think you have an issue, but when you tread into areas such as, you know, allegations of criminal behavior or abuse, placing someone in a false light, then you've got issues. But it really goes back to, you know, whether it's innocuous or incendiary, and kind of reminds me of the cover of the Nirvana album. I don't know how that ever ended up. But,
that naked baby in the water.
Yeah.
Didn't the guy grow up and file a lawsuit about that?
Yeah, he did.
But invasion. His parents had sold the picture to. Yeah, I'm going to have to research that. I'll post a link to an article about that under this episode as well. You know what I'm wondering is, what about Pat's book are his kids not happy about?
Yeah.
I mean, assuming that his, well, apparently he's having this, you know, with this discussion with his adult children. Now, if your adult children don't want you to write something about them in your book, and you're a loving, caring parent, you should just leave well enough alone and not write those things about your adult kids, about when they were younger. I wouldn't do that to my kids. Oh, and I've got plenty of interesting and embarrassing stories about my kids growing up, but I'm not going to publish them because I don't want to fracture my family. Certainly don't want to hurt my kids. Yeah.
Agreed.
All right, Brian, what's next?
All right. Moira writes us, asks, I hired a company to design and publish my book. They have a 100% satisfaction guarantee on their website. I'm very dissatisfied since it's been months since they haven't done any work. When I asked for a refund, they stopped responding to my emails. What can I do?
Well, this again goes back.
Depends on what country they're in.
It depends how you pay them.
Yep.
Most of those scammer websites have something on their site that says 100% satisfaction guarantee. That's James. You were talking about them using an NDA to create a sense of professionalism, but wouldn't they also put this in there, even though it's a lie,
that
to make it sound like they're legit?
Right. And then, I mean, who can ever, I mean, it's so subjective. Who could ever give you a 100% guarantee? And the easy way to push back on this is to say, all right, if there's a 100% guarantee, then why don't I place these monies in escrow? And once I approve the novel and approve its publication, then we'll release the funds. Well, you're going to get an emphatic not going to happen from the publisher.
Exactly.
So there's no such thing as 100% satisfaction guarantee. It's just not going to happen.
And again, they're using that as another scam tactic. People say, oh, I'm going to get all my money back if I'm not completely happy. You're not getting a penny back unless you used a credit card and you file a charge back on time. So, all right, Brian, what's next?
All right. Kim writes us, I am trying to come up with a unique title for my book, but whenever I think of a new one, I check Amazon and it's already being used. Can I use the same book title as one that's already for sale? What are the pros and cons of doing that? And can I get sued?
Well, I have an example. My favorite novel of all time is Swan Song. And by McGammon.
That's a great novel.
Yeah, my favorite book of all time. I bought copies for all my kids. I bought copies, gifts for friends. Robert McCammon. So one day I got on Amazon to order the book for another one of my friends. And I got another book, completely different book with the exact same title, because I guess I was in a hurry when I was on Amazon. I just clicked, you know, add to cart, buy. So you cannot copyright the title of a book. You will find multiple books on Amazon, sometimes dozens and dozens, with almost the exact same title. You can trademark a title if it's not already heavily used, and that's a whole different area of law. But if you don't want your book to get confused with all the other ones that have the exact same title or a very similar title on Amazon, you need to find something completely unique. Otherwise, what's going to happen to some of your readers is what happened to me. They're going to end up buying the wrong book.
I did that with my book because I titled it. It was during the BLM riots and all that stuff. And so I thought Blue Lives Matter, a book that was, you know, pro police officers would stick because it was, everybody was running around yelling Black Lives Matter. And I figured, okay, this will catch the eye because it, you know, when everybody was saying Blue Lives Matter, it seemed to really rile up the other side. I wasn't the only one thinking that way.
Uh-huh.
And there's got to be about 10 books out there now with the title Blue Lives Matter. So
not only that, a lot of products.
Yeah.
So you added a subtitle.
I did add a subtitle.
Heart Behind the Badge.
Yeah.
The book is about, it's not like a pro cop book. It's your memoirs of your days serving the public.
Yeah.
As a police officer. James, you were going to say something.
No, well, yeah, I had, you know, I thought we had this great, unique name, Maximum Impact, for the novel. And holy Moses, when I hopped on Amazon, there's got to be 50 plus novels with that title. And, you know, you hit it on the head. That's not copyrightable. And the only thing that I would do, you know, obviously, as an author, don't try to steal or use an iconic title. It just would be in poor taste, and I think it would reflect very poorly on the book. You know, if you were to come out with Catcher in the Rye or Of Mice and Men, there are certain iconic titles where don't even go down that path.
You'll just end up with 1,000 1-star reviews. Well, that's assuming 1,000 people buy your book. But yeah, no,
right.
Nobody. Once people catch on, one person's going to post a 1-star review on Amazon, and then everybody's going to see this isn't the real book. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to skip back up to one that I missed here.
I noticed you missed one. I thought you just didn't like it.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry. I missed it. I'm not wearing my glasses. Can I rewrite an old book that is now in public domain? My question is, why would you want to? But James, go ahead.
Yeah, no, there's obviously a reason for it. I'm not sure what Charles is getting at, but you know, as a general rule, copyright is going to be for the life of the author plus 70 years. I believe it's life of the author plus 50 years in Canada. You need more facts, but I'd love to know exactly what he's doing. But my advice is, if you were going to republish a book that's in the public domain, let's assume that factually 100% it's in the public domain, that I would go with an adaptation approach where and go out of your way to ascribe credit where credit is due, that, you know, most graciously and openly to the original author. This is an adaptation of an original work by, but yeah, I'm not, it's kind of interesting. There's a reason. So, but that's what I would do, is I would take the adaptation approach and to give credit where credit is due.
Yeah. And actually, there's a lot of authors doing this. They go and they find these really old books and they rewrite them, and they, you know, and oftentimes they make them better. So he absolutely can do it.
Yeah.
And you're right. Needs to give credit to the original, but sure. You know, I wish that somebody before I was in high school had rewritten all the Shakespeare books.
I was about to say, yeah, one reason for this could be something that's written in the older English that nobody can understand.
Yeah.
And rewrite it in a way that we with the modern English would understand.
Yeah.
So that would make sense. But I'm sorry, go ahead. But
there's also actually a negative implication. If you rewrite it and you rewrite it to make it significantly different from the original, you'll have a much better chance of getting it published, because Amazon and our printer, they don't like public domain books. You know why? Mm-hmm. Because there's thousands of the same book on their website.
Well, yeah.
Published by all kinds of different companies. Some of the scam companies, you ever see scammers, they go and they just publish it. They can, you know, anybody can get the text online. They republish these public domain books. So it looks like they have some books on Amazon. But and again, if you type in any popular old book on Amazon in quotes, you're likely to find, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of the exact same book for sale on Amazon. So, but rewriting is the way to go.
Okay. Cindy asks us, I noticed a third party seller on Amazon is offering one of my older published dog books with what is clearly a homemade fake cover. This book is likely out of print, and I get no royalties on it anyway, but it just seems wrong that this seller is allowed to do this. Is there anything I can do about it?
I have a example. So I was testing one of our competitors' websites. This is 20 something years ago, and I uploaded my ebook and had them put it on the market. I was just seeing how they did it. A woman emailed me and she thanked me so much for letting her buy my book and letting her republish it. And I went, what? That publisher had apparently put something in the description saying that the book was available for redistribution.
Really? Okay. So James, can Cindy do anything about this, I guess, copy of an old book of hers that has now a different homemade fake cover on it? I guess what she wants is to be able to take it down from Amazon.
One of the things that she could do, and Amazon actually responds to these, I know, well, I should say Barnes & Noble is quick to respond. There's called a takedown notice. It's a formal notice under the Copyright Act where you can allege that, hey, this is a violation, this is my copyright. As a general rule, they'll respond fairly quickly. In fact, most of these publishers have sections of their legal department that are set up specifically to respond to takedown notices. In addition, you see this with the scammers, where they'll actually take the title of a book or a song or a screenplay, and they'll exhibit it as their own, as an exemplar of their own work. So that's the route to go, is a takedown notice. I mean, it sounds here that she's kind of ambivalent, because, you know, I'm not getting royalties anyway, but Obviously, I would take umbrage with somebody who posted my book with a false cover, but that would be the route to go as a formal takedown notice. If Cindy happens to be listening, I'd be happy to give her a boilerplate takedown notice, and I'd be surprised if Amazon doesn't react fairly quickly. I know that
Well,
Barnes & Noble did when our book was published. Publishing Mojo had actually backdoored Barnes and Noble through Draft to Digital, and
without Draft to Digital knowing it was them.
yeah,
Draft
and
to Digital had already banned Publishing Mojo from their platform, so Publishing Mojo pretended to be the author to sign up with their program. Is that
and
correct?
yeah, and I was actually pleasantly surprised at how quickly both Draft to Digital and Barnes and Noble, it was a matter of days, and it was removed.
I actually have heard from lots of authors over the years who have found their books for sale on Amazon that were either copyright infringement or, more commonly, the publisher had gone out of business, but the books were first still for sale on Amazon. Well, guess who was getting the money from Amazon for those? The out of business publisher. So they would contact Amazon and say, look, this company published my book a long time ago. They're out of business. You're sending them money that's mine. Can you just take it off your website? And Amazon's typical response was, this is a civil issue between you and your publishers. Nothing we can do about it. Then I started advising authors to send Amazon a letter, copyright infringement notice. And that gets their attention. And I've written about this on Writers Weekly. I will post a link to that underneath this episode at writersweekly.com/podcast, so authors can use the specific language. You don't say, they published my book, they ripped me off, whatever. You say, this person is violating my copyright. I own the copyright to this book. Take them down. And Amazon will respond to those, and they'll take them down.
Okay. Jay asks us if my Amazon KDP account has been terminated, do you know any way I can get it back? Their last two emails have been very vague and say the same thing. You want me to read the email quote or?
I can do it.
Okay.
I'll do it fast.
Go ahead.
As we previously stated, we still detect activity for your books originating from accounts attempting to manipulate Kindle services. You're responsible for ensuring that strategies used to promote your book comply with our terms and conditions. I'm sorry, but we can't offer any additional insight on this matter. Basically, Amazon's saying, we're taking your book off the market, we're terminating your author account, and we're going to send you this paragraph that makes no sense whatsoever and makes accusations about things you didn't do. This is happening to authors all over, and Amazon KDP is terminating their accounts and keeping their unpaid royalties because that's what it says they can do in their contract. I know two authors who successfully recovered their Amazon KDP accounts. The others that were just screwed. And I get complaints about this all the time. So yeah, you can fight them, but it's just not, based on history, it's just not looking good. And why is Amazon doing this? I think bots are picking up things. And yeah. Okay, here's an example. Author submitted her files, she had her husband do it, to Amazon KDP. And her sister found a couple of typos when she bought the ebook. So the woman, the author's husband, went and fixed the typos and re-uploaded the file to Amazon KDP. And Amazon KDP accused the author of duplicating content that was already for sale on Amazon. It took her months and the help of a professional organization to get her account back. Months. By this time, she had already republished, she had two books through BookLocker, and her BookLocker versions were already for sale and on Amazon. So now her BookLocker books are on the market and they're on Amazon. And only then did she get her Amazon KDP account back. And she actually wrote an article for Writers Weekly recently about what occurred. She called it what KDP was, oh, killed by publisher or something like that. She made fun of it. But I will put a link to that article under this episode. Also, there are multiple articles on Writers Weekly that were either written about authors who were terminated by Amazon KDP or were written by victims who were terminated by KDP.
Okay, and looks like we have another copyright question here. I have a book in French published in Canada, copyright 1997. The author died in 1998 in Louisiana. I know that two of his four siblings are deceased and have not been successful in finding any of the other two. I can't find anything on the publisher, so I assume the publisher has ceased operations. Boy, that's a big assumption.
Right.
What do you advise if I would like to publish a translation?
Well, it's not your book. It's not your family. Either the author specifically left his or her copyrights to a family member when they passed, or it was left to their estate. And this person, CF, has no rights to that book whatsoever. If you can't contact the two remaining siblings that are still alive, tough luck. You cannot publish that book. You can't translate that book. You can't touch that book because it doesn't belong to you. I get this question a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the gall of, well, I can't find so-and-so. I'm pretty sure they would say yes anyway, so I'm just going to go ahead and do it. And I'm like, you're going to go ahead and get sued? And when the
soon as you write that book, those two siblings you couldn't find are going to suddenly find you.
That's right. And and they'll not only be entitled to, you know, attorney's fees and all kinds of expenses, but whatever royalties you earned on the book, they're going to be entitled to that too, because you don't own it.
Well, and the other thing too is that there's statutory damages in the United States. And it can be upwards to $250,000, irrespective of whether you made money off of that that copyright infringement. So,
right, and that's $250,000 per occurrence. So, if this person, let's say, published a print paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook, that could potentially be $250,000 times three. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Are we done with that one?
Yeah, let's go to the next one.
All right, so on to the next one. I name a couple of companies in my book, both airlines. The characters are passengers on their flights. I also mention two specific vehicles as the characters travel in them. Is this allowable?
I think we kind of covered this earlier, but James, you can give a short answer to RF.
RF. Now, it's actually, it was funny because I reached out to Angela and I said, there's actually a book called Dear American Airlines, and it was a national bestseller. I want to say it was O'Hare Airport. A person begins writing a complaint to American Airlines because the flight was canceled and several times, or I forget the specifics, but the book actually becomes an introspection into that person's life and the things that they've done wrong, the thing they've done right, who they hurt, and it became a national bestseller. So I think what it comes down to, there's no issue with, I'm driving a Ford Mustang, I'm driving whatever, I'm flying on this airline. The thing is, you know, does it cast the company in a bad light? And, you know, I don't know, I probably should research it, but I'm sure American Airlines got a lot of positive feedback from that novel, that it did not cast American Airlines, what started out as a complaint to American Airlines, you know, turned into a quite a novel. So it did not place the airline in a bad light.
And every airline has delays. Every person who's ever flown has experienced delays with airlines. So to say that an airline was delayed and then, you know, going on with the whole rest of his story about the passenger's life, it really wouldn't put them in a bad light because it happens every single day, all day long. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, obviously with the vehicles and that's the one that came to mind was Dear American Airlines. That's actually the title of the book.
All right, Brian. Who's next?
All right. An anonymous writer.
This is our last one.
Asks us, I need clarification on photo release forms. Do I need one for a picture in which faces are so distant or blurred that they are non-recognizable? What if you can only see one quarter of the person's face? What if the people in the photo have their back to the camera? Do I need their permission? What about people in other countries?
You know, this varies by country. The different country laws regarding publishing pictures of people. If if in the United States, if I go to the park, public park, and I take pictures of my kids, and there's kids in the background and there's adults in the background, I can publish those pictures because there's no expectation of privacy in a public arena and public place in the United States. If my friend comes to my house and gets really loaded on wine and passes out on my sofa, I cannot publish a picture of her. I mean, I'm not talking just in books, I'm talking online. That's she would have an expectation of privacy, and I could get into big trouble for publishing something like that. James?
No, you hit it on the head. The operative question is there a reasonable expectation of privacy? And you are also correct. And be very careful because countries differ. But you only need to look at the paparazzi to realize that, it's just insanity in terms of how far they're able to go without breaching a person's privacy interests. But once, as a general rule, once you're in the public domain, you're in the public domain. And you can look at the prong c conduct that is extreme and outrageous. But yeah, as a general rule, you don't have that expectation of privacy when you're in the public. But the important caveat is that it varies from country to country. Some countries are very protective of individuals' privacy.
I've talked to so many authors over the years, and there's a lot of family photos. So there's, a photo from a family reunion taken it in somebody's backyard, and they have, after I've given them advice, for people that are still living who have not given them permission to publish the photograph because it was on private property, they blur their faces out. Well, Uncle Jim doesn't want his picture in the book, so they just, recently was working with an author. She didn't want to put her kids' pictures in the book, so she replaced the kids' faces with like cartoon faces, and because it dealt with, there was a lot of privacy issues regarding that. And so, yeah, just because it's a group of people, you can't put everybody's pictures in your book without permission, unless it was in a public place in the United States where people had no expectation of privacy in that area. So I think that was it.
That
And
was
that
it.
was anonymous. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, that wraps it up. James, you got anything you want to holler out to us before we cut this off for the day?
No, that's it.
Well, we really appreciate your help, and our authors appreciate your help. You're a wealth of information. And what people don't know is a lot of authors send me questions and need advice, and I will often send those to James so he can give his input as well.
Can do
And
the research, yeah.
well, he knows
Yeah.
more than I do about the law, and of course he's probably got legal resources that I wouldn't
Yeah.
even know where to
Yeah.
look for. But he's always he always gives advice, and he never charges our authors for it. He's just you're an amazing guy.
My accountant has an issue with that, so I'm gonna have to work on that.
Right.
Well, put it
No,
down
it's
on your
actually it's
taxes as charity work.
what's that?
Put it on your taxes as charity work and try to get a deduction.
There you go.
Well, again, I want to thank you for all the help you provided to us and to our authors and to other authors that, that not even all our authors. So thank you very much for that. We're going to wrap this up for today.
Right, thanks for joining us, James.
Yep, you're always welcome here.
No problem.
And we'd like to thank all of you for joining us and listening in to our podcast. Check us out on writersweekly.com. That's writersweekly.com. And also, if you've got a book idea that you'd like to see published, go over to booklocker.com. And there you will find a contact link that you can click on, and that will send an email directly to Angela. You can ask her whatever questions you'd like, and you can speak directly to her. And that wraps it up for this episode. And we look forward to being with you all again next week on another episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast.